Please, the book of Numbers, chapter 11. As you recall, we're studying in the area of prayer. And in the area of prayer, we have been studying in the area specifically of answers to prayer. The types of answers, the why of answers, the kind of answers. We'll move on from that point in prayer to other areas. But right now, we're only studying the specific area of prayer that talks about when a petition or when a prayer is made. And I'm only talking about the areas of prayer where something is asked for. We're not talking about the kind of prayer that is praise, which is a valid area. We're not talking about the area of prayer that is worship, that is also a valid area. We're talking about the kind of prayer which is strictly something asked for kind of prayer. In other words, the type of prayer that God is addressed in terms of, will you do, or we request for you to do something for us. This is the type of prayer, to put it in very shoe-leather terms, where someone's coming down the wrong side of the freeway. The kind of prayer that is elicited at that time. Lord, please do such and such quick. And therefore, we're talking only about prayer which is petition. And in studying prayer which is petition, or prayer that asks for something, we had four or three areas, rather, that are important. And always when we study a prayer in a passage, and we'll look at, I think, probably four or five more of them this morning, we always need to ask, why was the prayer made? Or, really, when you say, why was the prayer made, we're looking at the motive. What moved you to pray? What made you pray? Why did you ask God for something? And that can be very simply expressed in one English word, and that is every prayer has a why behind it. In addition to the why, there is also the what. In other words, here is why I am praying. Now here is what I want. Or we might put that in terms of the specific and definite petition. We mentioned also last week that both of those are hard to determine because the why of prayer has to do with the motive, and very often we don't know exactly what we want, and therefore we don't know why we should ask. And the what also is very difficult because sometimes we know the motive or the thing that we would like to have, but we're not exactly sure what would satisfy that. So the why and the what, and then the how, deals purely with divine response. And we might add to that divine response is there is always one. God never fails to respond to prayer. Now, I know there are passages that talk about the fact that if I regard iniquity in my heart, the Lord will not hear my prayer. But that hear has to be answered in terms of effective prayer. It can't be answered in terms of the fact that if you're living in carnality, God suddenly becomes deaf. That would have a direct effect on God's omnipresence, God's omniscience. God knows everything. And it's not a matter of said, well, I suddenly became deaf. I don't know what you said because you are living in carnality. So when we talk about God not hearing prayer, we're talking about ineffective prayer. And remember, we distinguished between the two words last week, access and effectiveness. Access and effectiveness are not the same. A believer always has access. He is not always effective in terms of prayer. So the why, the what, and the how are always important. And we're simply going through passages and noting that when God responds with his answer, or the how part, he always responds to the petition, and he always responds to the motive. In other words, there is always a dual answer in terms of prayer. And our second example is Numbers chapter 11. Numbers 11. And the first thing always to look for is, why was the prayer made? And as we begin reading with verse 10, by the time we arrive at verse 11, nobody's going to have any difficulty realizing why the prayer was made. That will become very simple. Chapter 11, verse 10. And again, use your imagination, put yourself in the scene, make yourself Moses. And if you were Moses, wouldn't you be moved to pray in a situation like this? Then Moses heard the people weep throughout their families, every man in the door of his tent. Now just put yourself in that setting. You are the leader of Israel, and all of these people, the leader of the house, is sitting in the door of the house weeping. That ought to be enough if you would just go up and down your block in your imagination at your home, and everybody is sitting out of the front yard bawling, and you're responsible for their leadership. That would sort of motivate something on the inside toward prayer. And the anger of the Lord was kindled greatly. Moses also was displeased. That's an understatement. And Moses said to the Lord, "Wherefore hast thou afflicted thy servant? And wherefore have I found favor in thy, I not found favor in thy sight, that thou layest the burden of all this people upon me?" So they're all bawling. They're all his responsibility. Verse 12, "Have I conceived all this people?" He said that because it was Mother's Day. "Have I conceived all this people? Have I begotten them, that thou shouldest say unto me, Carry them in thy bosom as a nursing father beareth the nursing child unto the land which thou didst swear to give unto their fathers?" In other words, I am not their father. They don't get their sustenance from me. I didn't volunteer for the job. Verse 13, "From where should I have flesh to give all his people?" The basic problem is they were hungry, and they're griping and crying and bawling, and they want food. "For they weep unto me, saying, Give us flesh that we may eat. I am not able to bear all his people alone, because it's too heavy for me." Now, can you find enough why to pray? I can find plenty of why. In fact, I think it's really admirable that Moses prayed. To me, he should have quit and just said, "I resign with this weeping, bawling, bitching group of people. I'm done with them." And instead, the why, and you can see plenty of the motive. The motive is a complaining, childish, hungry, griping congregation. And in verse 15, he gives a petition. When you're in the midst of an intolerable situation, what would be the nice thing to do? Well, there's a home beyond the blue for every believer. So Moses says, "Take me to my home beyond the blue." And that is in verse 15. "If thou deal thus with me," and this prayer, again, two factors to it. Number one, God is going to say no to it. But number two, it does have merit. It's brief. It's a verb and a direct object. "If thou deal thus with me," verse 15, "kill me, I pray thee, out of thy hand." Out of hand. So the simple answer is, I'm in the midst of an intolerable situation. Kill me. Now just think logically. Is that a situation that is, or a prayer that is logical? And I'm not going to ask for hands, but have you ever in your life been in a situation where you were so motivated that the prayer could very logically be, "Lord, remove me"? Jim, have you ever prayed such? No? I would think with Century 21, real estate coming to town, and Era's sales going down, that you would naturally be motivated, "Lord, you know, remove me from the scene," which would be a very logical. Have you prayed that this week, by the way? They have attractive signs. Yes. So anyone, I'm sure, sitting here can identify with exactly what we're talking about. You've been in a situation that was bad enough that the motivation would simply be, "Lord, remove me." And that is a logical petition. That's an understandable petition. And Moses made it. However, notice the divine response. The divine response comes down in verse 16 and 17. "And the Lord said to Moses, gather unto me 70 men of the elders of Israel, whom thou knowest to be elders of the people, officers over the people. Bring them to the tabernacle of the congregation, that they may stand there with thee. And I will come down and talk with thee there. I will take of the Spirit which is upon thee, and will put it upon them. And they shall bear the burden of the people with thee, and thou shalt not, and thou bear it not thyself alone. So notice, kill me, petition, answer is definitely and strictly no. You're going to go on living. You're going to continue to breathe. My answer to your petition is an emphatic no. I will not kill you. I understand it's feasible. I see what you're asking for, but the answer is no. I also see behind the scene. And behind the scene, you are bearing a griping, complaining people. I understand that. Will I do something to relieve the load? Answer, yes, I will do something to relieve the load. And the how, or the divine response, was simply supply for the load. And may we repeat what we said last week. This is the most common, ordinary, typical answer to prayer that you can ever get. As a matter of fact, if you examine your own prayer life, you'll find over and over again that the petition made is very often not answered as we made it. However, God very often, many times, supplies the motive, the reason that was behind the petition and provides an answer for it. And there is another example in Numbers 11. Genesis 18. I hope we can begin to see by the time we get through these, let's see, this morning, that will be 6 case histories of that, including last Sunday. I hope we'll begin to see this morning that really what we ask for, or the petition in terms of prayer, is really no big thing. And we should not ever judge prayer by the answer or by the petition made. Incidentally, in terms of petition, what was the answer to Moses' prayer? He might as well have gone out and talked to a tree and ask a tree to kill him. As a matter of fact, he would have had more effective prayer if he had gone out and talked to the Philistines and said, "Philistines, kill me." And he would have gotten an answer to his petition immediately. So that very often the petition aspect of prayer is not really the important thing, though of course it must align with certain things as we'll study later on. All right, our next prayer is found in Genesis chapter 18. And again, we need to ask the 3 questions that are important for every prayer of a request type. And that is why, what, and how, because they all have them. And again, I hope we're fixing our proper category now. We're not talking about worship. We're not talking about praise. We're not talking about thanks. We're talking about only the category of prayer that asks for something, and only that category. Genesis 18. That, of course, does not make up all of prayer, and that's the reason we're separating this category. All right, beginning in chapter 18, verse 20. Our first question is simply, why did Abraham pray? What was his motive? What moved him? Beginning in verse 20. The Lord had said, "Because the cry of Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grievous, I will go down now, see whether they've done altogether according to the cry of it, which has come to me, and if not, I will know." And the men turned their faces from there and went toward Sodom, and but Abraham stood yet before the Lord. Now the petition is simply, or the situation is simply this. Sodom and Gomorrah has sinned a great deal. God goes down to take a look at the situation, as the following context will determine. he goes down to decide, shall I wipe out Sodom and Gomorrah? And he arrives on the scene to see whether he will wipe out Sodom and Gomorrah. Everyone removes themselves from communication with the Lord except Abraham. Why? And Abraham, throughout the context, is going to do some typical seed of Abraham dealing. He says, are there 50? Are there 40? Are there 30? Are there 20? Are there 10? But why would Abraham have any interest in a city called Sodom and Gomorrah being spared? That's what he's going to ask for. Notice beginning in verse 23, it says, Abraham drew near and said, will you destroy the righteous with the wicked? Why do you ask that? Now he begins to deal. Suppose there are 50 within the city. Wilt thou destroy it and not spare the place for the 50 righteous that are in it? Verse 28. Suppose there's a lack 5 of 50. Verse 30. And he said to me, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak. Suppose there be 30. Verse 31. He said to me, behold, I have taken upon me to speak unto the Lord. Suppose there shall be 20. And then down in verse 32, he says, O Lord, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak yet but this once. Suppose 10 shall be there. Will you destroy it for 10's sake? Now, what's Abraham going through all this for? Is he a bleeding heart for Sodom and Gomorrah? Is that the point? Is he just saying, I hate to see this nice city wiped out? Obviously, according to the nature of the city, Abraham, being the kind of man he was, would be thrilled to death to see Sodom and Gomorrah wiped out. But he asks God not to do it. Why? What's the reason? Just put yourself in the scene. Why do you suppose he's asking for the survival of Sodom and Gomorrah? Yeah, he's concerned about the righteous, but even bring it closer home to that. Remember, his nephew lives there. Relatives. Lot lived in Sodom and Gomorrah. His nephew Lot lived there. Consequently, with nephew Lot, he didn't want his nephew destroyed. That's understandable. God makes an announcement that he's going to level Kansas City. Your mother, father, and 3 brothers lived in Kansas City. Wouldn't you do some praying? Sure you would. You'd have a motive, and the motive would be the salvation of your family. So what does he do? Well, he makes a petition, and he goes in the petition from 50 down to 10. We'll not try to draw any conclusions about bargaining and prayer from this particular passage because they're really not there. But what Abraham is doing is that he knows Sodom and Gomorrah's got it coming. He knows it. And really, the idea of going from 50 to 10 is that it's sort of like Abraham saying, I hate to ask for anything, really. Seeing the wickedness and the depravity of Sodom and Gomorrah, I hate to even make any petition. But dare I start with saying, if there are 50? And when he does that, he is so motivated that Lot will get out of there alive. He says, could you shave 5 off? Could you make it 45 and still do it? And then he works up more courage and says, I know the place ought to be wiped off the face of the map. But he finally gets down as low as 10. And I take it the only reason he doesn't go any further than 10 is that he realizes the depravity of the city and he just can't quite work up the courage to say, let's bring it down less than 10. So, how does God answer? Look at chapter 19, same chapter, and verse 14. Well, first of all, verse 13, for we will destroy this place because the cry of them has become great before the face of the Lord, and the Lord hath sent us to destroy it. And Lot went out, spoke to his sons-in-law who married his daughters and said, up, get you out of this place, for the Lord will destroy the city. But he seemed as one that mocked to his sons-in-law. Verse 15, When the morning arose, the angels hastened Lot, saying, Get up, take your wife, your two daughters, which are here, lest you be consumed in the iniquity of the city. And, of course, Lot, in his typical fashion, while he lingered, the men, notice, in answer to the prayer made by Abraham for the salvation of the righteous, and again, you'd never conclude that Lot was righteous from this passage, but there is a passage in the New Testament that calls him righteous Lot. So he was a saved man. And in verse 16, while he lingered, the men laid hold upon his hand, upon the hand of his wife, and upon the hand of his two daughters, and the Lord being merciful to them, and they brought them forth and set him outside of the city. So notice, they physically have to pick up Job, they had to pick up Lot, removing outside of the city along with his wife and family, and get him out. So notice, how did God answer? God answered by the removal of Lot. Now, what did God answer? Did God answer the petition? Or did God look back and see what the petition had been? If there are 50, spare the city. If there are 10, spare the city. Answer, no. God did not spare Sodom and Gomorrah. God did not give Abraham what he asked for. Abraham did not receive a positive answer to his petition. Did he, however, see the salvation of his nephew Lot? Yes. And so the answer to that was yes. Can you see the futility of the type of teaching on prayer that says, and I'm sure you've all heard it, God answers prayer one of three ways. Yes, no, or wait. And God answers prayer in none of those three ways. God does not answer prayer yes. God does not answer prayer no. God answers prayer yes. And God also answers prayer no. And the majority of the times you're going to find that prayers fall in this category. What was asked for will probably not be received. The motivation or the why behind it, like the salvation of Lot, will be answered yes. Consequently, if someone would ask you, how did Abraham's prayer get answered? What are you going to say? He asked for the salvation of Sodom. Answer, emphatically, no. But he wanted his nephew Lot saved. Answer to that was yes. So that very often God looks behind to the why, and the what is negative. That ought to be relaxing also in terms of prayer, because so often we get uptight because what we ask for, we didn't get. And that's normal. And the reason that's normal is, being human beings, the what aspect of our prayer is very often very stupid. We just plain ask for dumb things. We all do. Why do we ask for dumb things? For a very simple reason. We just don't know what the answer to a big issue in life would be. We just don't have that capability. We're not omniscient. But we can be thankful that God always, and here's the principle that applies at this point, God never violates his omniscience. He knows what's best, and he is not going to answer what he knows is not best in a given situation. All right? Case number 4, Mark. Go to the New Testament. Notice the same principle working itself out. Mark 5. Same three questions. Why? What? And how? Mark chapter 5, beginning with verse 1. And they came over the other side of the sea into the country of the Gergesenes. And when he was come out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit, and the man again with the unclean spirit is going to be the man in the context making the prayer, who had his dwelling among the tombs. No man could bind him, no, not with chains. For he had been often bound with fetters and chains, and the chains had been plucked asunder by him, and the fetters broken in pieces, neither could any man tame him. And always, night and day, he was in the mountains, and in the tombs, crying, cutting himself with stones. I think you can see the condition that is obvious enough to motivate a prayer on the part of the man. But notice what happens down in verse 8. In verse 8, the Lord takes action. And verse 8 reads, he said to him, come out of the man, thou unclean spirit. And then he asked him what his name was. And verse 10, he besought him much that he would not send him away out of the country. But in the context, the man is, or he is cast out. Now, had you been in the situation of this man, demon possessed, the Lord comes along and relieves the demon possession. Notice that the man asks for something. It's down in verse 18. In verse 18, when he was come to the boat, he that had been possessed with the demon implored him. Now here's our petition. That he might be with him. So the what is, may I travel with you. In other words, he wants to become a member of the traveling party that went from place to place with Jesus Christ. Now, can you figure any of the why? Suppose you had been demon-possessed, cutting yourself, self-mutilation like this man. The Lord comes along and with one word casts out the demon. Then you say, can I join your team? Can I give the rest of my life to traveling with you? Why would he do a thing like that? I don't think that's hard to find out. Simple. Thankfulness. The Lord had done a great thing for him. And out of thankfulness, the man is motivated. I am really grateful for what you've done. Due to that, I have a petition, and my petition is, I'd like to travel with you. So notice the two parts. He's grateful for what's been done. That's very understandable. And second, the petition is, may I join your party and travel with you, down in verse 18. Very understandable. Verse 19, however. Howbeit, Jesus did not allow him. So notice, may I travel with you? No. You can't travel with me. He would not allow it. When Christ got in the boat, he says, you stay on the shore. But the man was thankful. And he wanted to express that thankfulness. So notice the latter part of verse 19, reading all of it again. Howbeit, Jesus allowed him not, but said to him, go home to your friends. Tell them what great things the Lord has done for thee, and hath compassion on thee. And he departed and began to publish in Decapolis what great things Jesus had done for him, and all men did marvel. His motivation was thankfulness, and again, coupled with that was naturally a desire to tell what great things the Lord had done for him. And since he wanted to tell the great things the Lord had done for him, his request is, Lord, let me travel with you. How did the Lord answer? Go home and tell. What kind of answer did he get to his prayer? To his petition to become a traveling evangelist? No. To his desire to tell people what Christ had done for him, the answer was affirmative, or yes, you may do this. This has lots of application. Been saved by God's grace, and let's see how typical this is. saved by God's grace. You grow in grace. And here's a guy that was a complete dropout in life, couldn't hold a job, couldn't make anything work out in life, lived a depraved life, and suddenly he got saved. And what's the first thing he's going to want to do? He wants to tell. And what's his petition going to be? It's logical. He'll even get his petition motivated from the pulpit. Well, I say, man, you've been so low and so bad and so depraved, you'd make a super-duper extraordinary what? You ought to go to seminary and become a preacher and do this thing full time, because you can tell people how low you were and how high God lifted you. There's no other logical answer for you except to become a preacher. And therefore, robber becomes preacher. And he asked God to make him one. And God's answer to that, generally speaking, is no. You're not a robber anymore. Just become a witness. Don't plague the body of Christ by telling everybody what a crook you were. But that's generally what they do anyway. But at any rate, notice the man's motivation. He wanted to tell. Did he get to tell? Yes. Did he get what he asked for? No. Are you reading me? You ever prayed this way? Ever had things turn out this way? And maybe not seen the whole scenario. And the guy could have gone home mad. May I travel with you? Unappreciative Jesus said, no, you can't, when I'm willing to go along and help his team. And we often make similar petitions. Lord, I want to do this. I want to do it for you. And God just slams the door and says no. And we get mad and say, what happened to my prayer? Didn't get answered. Sure, it got answered. We're just not looking at the right place. We're expecting our little petition to move the throne. And when you come down to it, it's really ridiculous, isn't it? Really, the idea that God should permit me to ask him anything, that's kind of far out in itself, isn't it? Me, knowing absolutely nothing, have the privilege of saying, God, do this. Really, you got a sense of humor? Isn't that funny? God, the omniscient sovereign of the universe, sits up there and says, I'll listen to your blabber. Isn't that unbelievable? That's grace on top of grace. Not only will I listen to what you say, but would you like to ask me for something? You know, you've got a problem. You see your answer. Would you like to tell me what to do in response to your answer? And when you think of it, on the face of it, that in itself is a tremendously gracious thing on God's part. And, of course, becomes even more interesting when we recognize that so often we do ask our little petition, don't get it, and get mad and say God doesn't answer our prayers. Or we go into a little cocoon and say, well, I know why I didn't get an answer. I was carnal. And that has no bearing whatsoever on the situation whatsoever. Can you see the pattern set up in these prayers? The why, the what, and the how. All right, let's try another one. John 11. Three factors: why, what, and how. John chapter 11, beginning with verse 1. What we're really coming down to, and we're going to discover, is that God answers a whole lot of prayers, but not a whole lot of petitions. John 11. Now, a certain man was sick, named Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister Martha. I think you can already read what the why is going to be, because it works with all of us. Anybody who gets sick or has an ache or pain is going to do what? That is very adequate for motivation in prayer, which also does give a little focus even on our motivation sometimes. Very often, a pain in the side, or we go to the doctor and he finds a lump, that can very often motivate prayer much quicker than anything else in the world. And so in verse 1, we all should already have a hint of what's going to happen. A certain man was sick, named Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister Martha. It was that Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment, who wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. Therefore his sister sent unto him, saying, now here will be our petition, Lord, behold, he whom thou lovest is sick. Now, the petition, notice, is basically in this context information. Just, Lord, the one that you love so much is sick. But I think in the interpretation of the passage, you know what they meant, don't you? Lord, you're powerful. You can perform miracles. Our brother is sick, and we want you to know about it. And you know what that means. Someone calls you on the phone. Your brother has had an accident. He's in the hospital. He's in intensive care. They hang up the phone. Now, what is that? Information? No, that's not information. The fact that he's been injured, he's in intensive care, it's too strong to say, come on, hurry down. You just give the information, and the what is implied. So the idea is Lazarus is sick. Do something. They were not simply giving information. The petition was do something, and the do something was obviously come down and heal Lazarus. The motivation behind it was very simple. Why did they pray that? They had a sick brother. Okay, why did they pray? Sick brother. What did they pray? Come on down and do something. Now, how did the Lord reply? And the how is going to involve two things this time. The first part of the how is he answered the petition, Lazarus is sick, do something. He answered it by delay. Or he didn't do anything. Notice chapter 11, verse 6. When he heard, therefore, that he was sick, he abode 2 days still in the same place where he was. Notice the Lord came running. Sick man. Matter of fact, we'll find in a context a dying man. And how does the Lord answer the prayer? He answers it in verses 6 and 7 by doing nothing. Then verse 7, notice, after that, after he delayed for a matter of, 2 days. Then after that, he says to his disciples, let's go to Judea again. Now, you say, well, he must have been held up by feeding a few thousand on the mountain or a couple of sermons or Amtrak or something of that sort. What delayed him? Well, the interesting thing is the delay was intentional. He stayed where he was 2 days. Now, here's the additional thing. In the interim of 2 days, parentheses, in the interim, Lazarus died. Isn't that nice? Your brother's in intensive care. He's in critical condition. You had a luncheon appointment, so you didn't make it. You had the afternoon off. You played golf. You stayed overnight because you had dinner with friends, and you weren't in any big hurry. You had an appointment the next morning, plus you had another round of golf the next morning. You played it, and at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you get the word, your brother's dead. How would you look with the family? Really concerned, wouldn't you? Really concerned. Very important point. don't ever, ever conclude anything about God's character from the way He answers your prayers. Again, get back in the scene. Look at that delay. Lazarus died. What conclusion would you have about... back there at verse 1. Or verse... Verse 3, rather. Lord, behold, he whom thou lovest is sick, and he stays it out until he dies. Can you come to any conclusion on a human level? I'd say go back at verse 1 and scratch out 3 rather and scratch out that word love. I can see how much he loves him. He loves him enough to get to delay until he dies. Yeah. Right. Right. That's just what we're coming to. You just grabbed the thunder. I'm trying to make you mad at Jesus for just a minute. That's all. So that we can see what we'll get glad about him for in a minute. Okay? But notice again, can you see the danger that would come at this point? Just suppose we hadn't got down to that verse 15 yet. And have you ever had God do anything like that to you? Have you ever had him make a petition? Say, hey, this has got to be quick. If you don't come through, it's all going to be blown. And you know what? He didn't. You ever had him pull that on you? And then you get a little bit peeved. God is love, omnipotent, omniscient. Let's tuck those notes away for a while and forget them. Because he just isn't coming through. And let's face it, on the basis of this, there would be every human reason to say that he wasn't coming through. Now, move from there down to verse 14. Notice verse 14, he does die in the interim. Then said Jesus to them plainly, Lazarus is dead. Now verse 15. He responds by delay. And second, he responds by miracle. And that's in 11:15. As well as 43 through 44. Look, first of all, at 43 through 44. Verses 43 and 44 will indicate the miracle. Chapter 11, verse 15 and 11:45 will indicate the divine reason behind it. 43. And when he had thus spoken, he cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. And he that was dead came forth, bound hand and foot with grave clothes, and his face was bound with a cloth. Jesus says to him, loose him, let him go. So notice, instead they ask for a healing, right? They ask for medicine. And what did they get? They got a man coming out of the grave. So notice, what they asked for, they did not get. They did get something considerably better. And why did God give them something better than what they asked for? Verses 15 and 45 tell us why. Verse 15. He says, I'm glad for your sakes that I was not there, to the intent that you might believe. Nevertheless, let's go to them. So notice in verse 15, the intent of the negative answer to the prayer was an increase in faith. And also notice there was an intent also expressed in verse 45. Then, upon the occasion of the raising of Lazarus, many of the Jews who came to Mary, who had seen the things which Jesus did, that is, the raising of Lazarus, believed on him. So our second reason was evangelism. Now, when you look at the whole scene, notice that the omniscient reason of the Lord is far in excess of what they asked. What they asked for wouldn't have been a big deal. The Lord could have gone down there. Lazarus was sick. Sure, he could have healed him. He could have brought him back. He could have been up running around in 5 days. What effect would that have had on their faith? Some. What effect might that have had on evangelism, the people that saw the scene? Probably some. But what about raising a man from the dead? What effect would it have on their confidence in the resurrection? Tremendous increase in faith. What effect did it have on evangelism? Tremendous effect. Notice the Lord answered in terms of what was best for them, in terms of his own view, not in terms of what they, in their own really lack of insight, asked for. So we can really say in connection with that, that God completely ignored a petition in order to grow, cause faith to grow. So his answer as to how Lazarus is sick, do something like heal him, no, not going to do it. Got a sick brother, is about to die. You going to care for that? Yes, I am. Notice again his motivation behind it. So we can finish this category, turn quickly to 2 Corinthians 12:7. And again, it's why, what, and how. We'll go just a couple of seconds over time. 2 Corinthians 12:7. In going through this, are you identifying with this kind of prayer? And this come, I always used to dread hearing someone talk on prayer for the simple reason that it was going to, you know, ask what you will and God will give it to you. And you'd look at that and there she is, big as life, God will give you what you ask for, and your expectations soar way up, and then you try it out. Nothing works. And you go way down and you say, well, I guess this prayer thing is just something I don't grasp. I'm not good enough. I haven't arrived a degree of sainthood that I can pray and get anything done. But look at these prayers. This you can identify with because this is the typical prayer life of the believer. 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 7. Lest I should be exalted above measure through the abundance of revelations, there was given me a thorn in the flesh. Why did Paul ask for its removal? Thorns hurt. That's obvious enough reason. Petition, verse 8. For this thing I besought the Lord 3 times, take it away. What did he ask for? Take it away. 3 times. Why do you want to take it away? Thorns hurt. Answer, verse 9 rather. He said to me, my grace is sufficient for thee. My strength is made perfect in weakness. Paul's conclusion, therefore, was I will glory in my weakness that the power of Christ may rest upon me. How did God answer? God answered by giving grace for the hurt. Not removal of the hurt. What was Paul's petition? Paul's petition was, I want removal. What was the answer to the removal? No. I'm not taking it away. What was the answer to the pain? The answer to the pain was grace. And we know it was an answer because Paul said, I got so much grace for the pain that I now rejoice in my thorn because it manifests the power of God. And this should indicate to us the pattern that prayer often follows. And it entails the submission of our mind to the will of God And therefore, prayer literally becomes fun because you can do lots of things with it. You can make a petition, and I frequently do this, make a petition and back off and then say, we're going to have fun because I'm going to get to laugh at myself because God is going to show me how much He wants to answer the motivation to the prayer and how dumb I am in what I ask for. And therefore, and I know this may sound very strange on the subject of prayer, but I've heard a lot stranger on the subject of prayer, it's kind of fun. Ask God for something and then learn to laugh at yourself when you don't get it, and then learn to thank Him for how much better what he saw the situation in the light of His omniscience, allowed you to make a dumb petition, and then gave you the best thing in answer in terms of prayer. Now you say, well, does it always work that way? Well, we're going to find something next Sunday that will be very, very vital. If I have a mental attitude that I'm going to get it, I mean, so help me, God is going to, I'll scream until I get it. I'll butt my head on the wall until I get it. I'll pray all night until I get it. I'll get my friends together and we'll form a prayer band. And with our trumpets and no, we'll form a prayer band and get together and we'll gang up. You know, man, where two or three are gathered in my name, God am in a corner. You know that verse? And we're going to gather together and we're really going to we're going to put time to it. We're going to put sacrifice to it. We're going to fast and we're going to bombard the gates of heaven. They're brass now, but we're going to split them open. And God might, and we'll find some cases where He does, say this. This will become very important, and just plant it in your mind for next Sunday. There are times when God gives you what you ask for as discipline. He said, okay, you are so stubborn and you are so insistent that you're going to have it. I'm going to give it to you. It's going to kill you. And to follow the pattern, I take it, Paul could have begged and begged and begged and begged and begged for the removal of the thorn in the flesh. And according to some other passages, God could have said, all right, Paul, I've heard it. All I want to hear it. Boo. There goes your thorn in the flesh. And Paul would have ended up a wreck. So God can give us our discipline via prayer when we insist on a petition. Perhaps you know some examples that we'll look at. Israel said, give us a king. We want a king. We want a king. God says He'll kill you. We want a king. Okay, take your king. He killed him. We're hungry. We don't like this manna. We can't stand it. We want quail. And God buries them in 5 feet of quail until they can't stand it. And we'll find patterns just exactly like this in Scripture. And we'll indicate the tremendous importance of a motivation, an attitude of submissiveness in prayer that is tremendously important. And very often we miss submissiveness in prayer. And you know what we call it? We say, oh, I'm only praying in faith. And instead of praying in faith, we're praying in stubbornness and rebellion. And we'll find out some of those patterns next Sunday morning. Father, we're thankful for Your word and for the privilege of prayer in Christ's name. Amen.